Good evening, folks. This is the Climb Side Podcast, and the hosts are Brian Rigby.
Hi.
And Tom Herbert. And this is a very late one coming. I think the last time we did this recording was somewhere in July, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right, Tom. Sometime in July, then life got had some unexpected twists and turns, but we're back. We're excited to bring you this episode on Fatmetabolism, the last of our triptych of the macronutrients. So take us away, Tom.
Yeah, so this, I mean, we left this one to be the third because this basically is the other side of the coin on carbohydrate metabolism. So, you know, as we explained in the last show, when we're looking at power output and when we're looking at fueling the climbing, whether it's bouldering or sport or leader, things like that, is that we are trying to maximize the amount of power that we're producing. And that's predominantly going to be provided by carbohydrate metabolism. But as we spoke about, the energy continuum is not a kind of on-off. You don't use one substrate and then after a certain amount of time, another one takes over. But rather, there's this pool of energy sources which provide us the ATP. And so tonight, we're just going to chat about basically the third, the fat metabolism and its contribution, which is part of aerobic metabolism. So, Right. Yeah.
Exactly. The third fat. And as Tom mentioned, kind of the flip side of the coin from carbohydrates, as we talked about in protein, the episode on protein is not a significant contributor to energy. It's really fat and carbohydrates. And while carbohydrates are this powerful source of energy that's very rapid, able to both be burned anaerobically and aerobically, able to regenerate ATP in a much faster manner, fat does not have that same capability. But it is a ubiquitous fuel source. It is the fuel source that we are burning 24/7. We're always burning fat. Most of the time, it is the predominant fuel source that our body is using. I say predominant and most of the time because most of the time we're sedentary, unless you are still out and about running around all day doing your errands. If you're not exercising, predominant fuel source is fat. But it does have some downsides. Despite being ubiquitous, it is aerobic only, and it is also subject to some bottlenecks.
Yeah, so with fat, we're going to have to supply it. There has to be oxygen present for this. Now, what's interesting, right, about the body is that we can think of it as Brian said, is that fat is constantly being burned, and we can think of it in terms of. When the way our bodies work is we have a kind of rate of work, which is what we call power, and we have the capacity for work. And our bodies are set up in such a way that we have this fuel source, which is abundant. We're talking about thousands or 10,000s of calories of fat that the average person can have. But what's tricky about this is that over time, in sports science and in athletic endeavor, we've been trying to see if we can maximize this almost unlimited fuel source in the body. And unfortunately, no matter how much we try, we are still limited by its metabolism because of mainly two things. One is the fact that oxygen has to be present for it. And two, it's really the transportation of these of the fat from our source, our basically our body sources. And we have two main sources of where fat is stored. So fat is stored predominantly in the adipose tissue, so that's your body fat. And we can store these fatty acids in our muscle tissue as well. So. Yeah, Brian, do you want to talk a little bit about, let's see here, I'm just looking at the notes here. So do you want to describe a little bit about the two, basically the delivery of fats during
Yeah.
exercise.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as Tom mentioned, it's kind of the dream that we could use more fat during exercise, and it makes total sense why sports scientists would be interested in trying to maximize the burning, the oxidation of fat for exercise, because it is a virtually unlimited fuel source. We're definitely going to run out of steam in some other way beyond losing, access to fat before, before we quit being able to exercise. But it's got some limitations that are kind of hard built into it. So the first limitation, and probably the greater of the two limitations when it comes to just the overall purpose of fat within exercise, is that it cannot be transported efficiently to the muscles. Unlike carbohydrates and proteins, or amino acids, I should say, which are water soluble and able to be dissolved within the blood and carried without any special aid, fat is fat soluble as only, and it is not water soluble, which means that it requires a protein to bind to in order to make that fat molecule water soluble and able to be transported in your blood. We cannot transport fat without the presence of that, otherwise we would just have globulates of fat floating around in our blood, which would be bad for many obvious reasons. The downside, though, is that we have a limited number of these fat transporting proteins, and we need them for a variety of purposes. So, for example, we need them to bring the fat from our diet once it's absorbed into our intestinal wall, into the enterocytes there. We require a fat transport protein to deliver them to the adipose tissue or possibly to the working muscles. But then we also require that same molecule, that same fat transport protein, to transport the fat or the free fatty acids from the adipose tissue to the working muscles. We have a limited number of these transport proteins, and once we run out of them, then it is saturated. You can think of it essentially as as a public transportation system where it can only load, you can only get so many people onto a bus at one time, and once it's full, you can't put anything more onto it. So we have a limited number of buses shuttling our fat molecule, these fat molecules around, and once you run out of them, you can't deliver any more to the muscles. So that is a huge limitation when it comes to it. And our body has one small workaround, which is that as you do more exercise, and particularly as you do more endurance exercise, exercise that really is below the aerobic threshold and that you have sufficient oxygen for, our body learns to store more and more fat within the muscle cells themselves. And that way it gets around this limitation. And if you look at charts of how what fuel source becomes dominant, and you split that chart down even further into where the fat comes from within the body, you can see that as you near the aerobic threshold, as exercise intensity increases above the point where you're walking, your heart rate's normal and exercise is easy and not at a hard pace, and you move towards this level where you're breathing really hard and you are running out of oxygen, but you still have enough to burn fat efficiently, you'll see that more and more fat comes from the muscle cells themselves and less comes from the adipose tissue. Which isn't to say that you don't burn fat from the adipose tissue. You do, but it's after the fact. So your body catches up after exercise and it re will replenish that fat, those fat stores within your muscles with fat from the adipose tissue now that you've got oxygen reavailable and, the line for the bus, so to speak, has dwindled.
The other thing I'll just add in there as well, which is related to this transportation, is the fact that one of the other limitations with this transportation is blood flow to the tissues. So we have this limitation in terms of the transporters, but also whether or not those muscles or rather adipose tissue is going to be supplied with blood. So what you've got to think of is as you are exercising and actually as your exercise intensity is increasing, more and more blood flow is going to be diverted to the working muscles. And it's doing that for the sake of bringing oxygen to the working muscles. So this actually then moves that blood flow or the rate of blood flow from the adipose tissue. So that's one of the other ways that the rate of fatty acids that are entering into the bloodstream is limited. It's also why,
Right.
just as an aside, it's also why patterns of fat in the body can, well, let's put it like this. In terms of, everyone knows about stubborn fat loss or areas of the body that have fat that is difficult to lose. And that is related to different receptors, but also in terms of the blood flow going to that area. Second limitation there.
Yeah. So beyond that, the other limitation is that fat is a virtually oxygen devoid molecule. There are atoms of oxygen within the molecule at the at the ends, but the portion that we burn for energy is comprised of carbons and hydrogens, and no oxygens unless it's a specialized fat molecule. But those are not going to be used for energy. Those are have other utilitarian purposes elsewhere in the body. So what we are burning for energy has carbons, it has hydrogens, it does not have oxygens, unlike a glucose molecule, and therefore it requires, in order to oxidize, more oxygen from elsewhere. And where do we get the oxygen? We get it from breathing in, and that means that you need just to breathe a little bit harder for every mole of fat that you burn than you do for every mole of glucose you burn. It's not a tremendously higher amount. It's only about 10% more oxygen, but that's pretty significant when we're talking about exercise. And if you think that you have to breathe 10% more oxygen in for every bit of fat that you burn compared to glucose, then that will add up quite significantly over time.
Yeah, and that goes into, funny enough, with exercise, though we can produce a lot of power, a lot of energy from burning fat, there is a level where the effort required to produce that performance is going to, quote, feel harder if you're metabolizing more fat. And that goes into the case of the fact that you're going to have to breathe harder. So this is the interesting thing about it, is that though we have this abundant energy source and that we can metabolize it and it generates a greater amount of ATP through the cycle, the requirement on oxygen means that we have this now limitation in terms of our respiratory fitness, and also the perceived exertion, or its limitation in terms of the amount of oxygen we can maximally consume per minute. So, right. What's funny about all this is that if we had, say for argument's sake, we're going to simplify it. If we had an ability to choose between metabolizing fat predominantly for energy while we're running and breathing at a certain rate versus carbohydrate, we would still want to predominantly use carbohydrate with oxygen to provide energy, because we would be able to produce more power from burning glucose with oxygen than we would fat with oxygen. So this is the interesting thing, is that we're not saying that it doesn't matter that you want to increase your ability to metabolize fat during exercise, but what we're saying is that even so, which we stressed a lot in the podcast on carbohydrate, is that carbohydrate is still the more efficient fuel, because it's more efficient in terms of it requires you can produce more power per oxygen than you can with fat.
Right. And that's you can kind of see how the study goals that are currently being pursued have changed with this new understanding of this, or I shouldn't say new understanding, but this further understanding and how we're changing the question. So it used to be, and fat adaptation is still, a huge idea within the world of sports science, but I would say that now It's more popular amongst, you know, obviously like ketogenic athletes and stuff like that. But it used to be that we thought, okay, well, what happens if we become fully fat adapted? Because the hope was that you would just learn to burn fat better and you would not affect carbohydrate metabolism at all. You know, so you would, in essence, get the best of both worlds. Suddenly you'd be burning fat wherever you could, which would be ideal, you know, maximally using whatever oxygen you have to burn fat and then have the leftover carbohydrates fuel that remaining bit that you need for more power. But what we've discovered through a number of studies is that the better you become at burning fat, the worse you become at burning carbohydrates. It's a trade-off. So when you become fully fat adapted, you feel great. Many people do anyway, but you lose a lot of power and you don't realize that you lose that power, but you have lost that power because you're no longer burning carbohydrates. And carbohydrates are, not only are they better at producing energy with oxygen, but they're also the only dietary energetic molecule that we can consume that can be burned anaerobically. So you've just eliminated an entire anaerobic pool. So the question now is, with these studies, is how do we maximize fat burning without affecting fat or without affecting carbohydrate burning? Because you want to maintain your ability to burn carbohydrates. And if you lose that ability, then you're going to lose performance. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and that's the really key thing. And this is one of the things we really want you to take away from this is, again, it is a lot of the discussion between wanting to be fat adapted or carbohydrate adapted is wrongly about the fact, or the fact is not the right word, is the perception that somehow carbohydrates are bad, right? So again, go back to our previous podcast to listen to us rant all on about that. but this is key, is that we do want to increase our ability to mobilize fat at higher intensities as we train. And that is predominantly caused by a training effect. Endurance training and things like that. We want to increase our ability to, we want to improve our cardiovascular ability so we can consume more oxygen and be able to handle it better. But at the end of the day, we're still not going to pass much more than 50% of our energy requirements at intensities by fat, which is not going to improve that much. And the key thing, as Brian said, is that we're seeing in the latest studies that we're actually hampering power. And again, I go back to this thing, which I remind everybody, is that there's a difference between the rate of work and the amount of work. And at the end of the day, we want to be able to increase our ability to do short bursts of power when we need it. There's no point being able to climb very slowly and steadily for 3 hours, that doesn't exist. All the studies that have shown a so-called performance improvement with highly fat adapted athletes is the fact that they can just keep going. What it doesn't show is that they can keep going and then when they require power, as in say a sprint at the end or even a maximal speed during a race, that is hampered. So, you know, when we're looking at marathon runners who are running incredibly quickly, they are not maximizing their fat metabolism as such. They're maximizing their ability to metabolize carbohydrate over the course of the race, because this is going to produce the power. For climbers, right, we want to have the best ability to have glucose stores or glycogen stores available so that as we do these muscle contractions, we are going to be generating power, and we're going to be restoring our phosphocreatine system, and we're going to be able to do this intermittent bouts of high power, high contraction work.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one thing that a lot of these studies have tried to compare the power output of a ketogenic athlete and a regular diet athlete, one thing that they've consistently done, I'm not going to say messed up on, but one study parameter that is consistent is that they're often subjecting the athletes to a trial that is under the aerobic threshold. So it's well within their ability, but this doesn't really reflect how athletes work out in real life, aside from maybe a small number of ultra endurance athletes. To use that marathoner again, you know, the marathoner doesn't want to run the marathon completely within their aerobic range, because if they do that, they're going to lose. What they really want to do is run right at the level where by the end of the race, they have tapped out their glycogen. You know, right to the point where they have spent not only, you know, tapped into that basically unlimited source of fat calories, but also used their carbohydrate, those power calories, to the greatest extent that they possibly could, because that is the fastest that they can possibly run that race. And their goal is to win. It's not to just run a marathon, you know, run 26 some miles for fun and feel great afterwards. Their goal is to run as best as they can and just maybe feel trashed by the end of it, but win. And it's the same thing with climbing. The goal isn't to, you know, climb for as many hours as you possibly can and feel okay. The goal is performance, you know, provided that is what your goal is. Obviously, if you're climbing for fun, you might have different goals. But if your goal is performance, then it's not how long can I possibly climb for without feeling fatigued. It's how hard can I climb? And to climb your hardest, you're going to need those power calories, which only come from carbohydrates. It's great. The better, the more fat you can burn while doing it, the better it is, because you're going to spare glycogen. You're going to be able to climb a little bit longer. But the moment that you're burning those fat calories instead of the carbohydrate calories, when you need that power, you're going to lose performance. If you reach, you know, a sudden move that requires, that's highly dynamic and requires a burst of power to get you to the next hold, you're not going to be able to find that burst of power within you. And you're done at that point. That's the end of your climb. It doesn't matter if you feel like you could continue up a ladder for another, you know, 500 yards. That's not what the climb is about.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's it. It's the easiest way to think about it is that what studies have been trying to do is to spare glycogen. All these fat adaption studies have all been about how do we spare glycogen so that we can use glycogen when it's needed. And unfortunately, there has been no study that has shown a performance increase with adapted athletes. There just hasn't been. You know, we're not lying there. What we're finding is that performance in terms of power output is limited.
Right.
Well, let's move on to the dietary. But just before that, I just want to give, because I just have a few bullet points from one of a very big study that was done on fat adaption. And I'm not going to go into details of the study, but I just want to give people some rates of fat metabolism. And the reason I want to do that is just so you can kind of understand what, how much fat you're metabolizing at exercise and how much you're burning daily, which should give you some indication of the potential for fat loss, right? Because a lot of people think about fat loss during when we talk about fat. So in this one study called the FASTER study, this is the highest rates of fat oxidation that they've recorded to date. And so these trained athletes were put on, these are ultra marathon runners, they were put on a 70% fat diet. And what they managed to get to is around about 1.54, so 1.5 grams a minute. Right. One of the subjects had 1.8 grams a minute. So that's how much fat they were oxidizing per minute while they were running, 1.8 grams. Okay. Highly trained individuals can get up to about 0.7 grams per minute. Moderate trained people is about 0.4. Some low trained individuals, 0.2 grams per minute. This is during exercise, right? So the average gym goer is probably metabolizing between 0.2 and 0.3 grams a minute, right? And then during the day, as we're walking around, we're metabolizing about 0.1 grams per minute. So it's just so some of those numbers, so you can kind of run them around in your head and do a little calculation of what you're expecting to be able to metabolize per day. You know, it's not going to be 300 or 400 grams of fat a day, even if you're running on a treadmill for an hour. So,
right.
Yeah. just to not to discourage you, but just to give you some idea that we don't metabolize grams of fat per day. So now talking about dietary fat. So
right.
Let's see. Yeah, carry on, Brian. Carry on.
Yeah, I mean, so fat, you know, as we talk about for exercise, it's kind of a boring fuel. Doesn't have the same performance and power aspects as carbohydrate does. But when it comes to talking about it in a dietary sense, I think it's very interesting. And there's a lot more variety to it. And there's a lot more questions that people have about it. So we kind of want to address some of these aspects, hopefully, and do it in an interesting way, not just lecturing, but talk about it and hopefully get some of these questions answered. So a few of the things that we want to cover in this short span here is, you know, talking about how the length of the fat molecule matters, talking about what the types of the fat molecules, and how that can vary. And then beyond that, especially when we're talking about different types, the sorting down into like omega-3s versus omega-6s and, medium chain triglycerides and the short chain ones that come from fiber, and then cholesterol as well, a little overview of dietary cholesterol, even though that's in many ways a very different topic than dietary fat.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about fat, right, what we're really talking about, so if we look at the fat in your fat cells, in your adipose tissue, and the fat, say, in the butter on your toast, we are talking about a molecule that is made up of fatty acids, which have different lengths, that are joined to it's a like a sugar alcohol background called glycerine or glycerol. So fats, when we generally see them or come into contact with them, are what they call triglycerides. And quite simply, you can think about it, the fact that when you eat a piece of toast, you will break down that triglyceride into its three fatty acids. Those will get taken up in a transporter, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And then when they get to the adipose tissue or the muscle, they get actually recombined back into this triglyceride form. The rate, if we just quickly go back, the rate of fat being released into the blood is basically this breakdown from this three fatty acid triglyceride to the fatty acids. So what's interesting is that these fatty acids that we have in our diet can be, or rather this triglyceride can be made up of various different lengths of fatty acids. And these fatty acids all have different properties. So we have the saturated fatty acids, monosaturated, polyunsaturated, and then we have something else called trans fat. So Brian, would you like to go through the four of those?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So the difference between these is really just, it's a chemical one. It's a chemistry difference. It's how they are constructed. So a saturated fat has no double bonds within it. All the bonds are single. It's called a saturated fat because the hydrocarbon tail of that fatty acid is saturated with hydrogens. It contains as many hydrogens as it possibly could. And structurally, what this does is it makes the fat a very straight. It forms this straight line. Obviously, you can't see individual molecules of fat, but that straight line allows the fat to solidify at a much lower temperature than unsaturated fats. So that's the basic idea behind a saturated fat. A monounsaturated has one double bond within it, which gives it a kink, makes it so it can't stack nicely. It does not become solid at nearly as low of a temperature, or nearly, they tend to be liquid. Let's just put it that way. And polyunsaturated has two or more of these double bonds, which allow it to kink. Now, trans fats are kind of an interesting side case because they're not, contrary to what I think a lot of people believe, they're not all man-made. There are trans fats within nature. In fact, there was a big hype about what were they called? Like transbasanic acid, conjugate, the CLAs basically. There was a big hullabaloo maybe 5 years ago about these fats that came from dairy. You couldn't get them in nearly that large of an amount from dairy, not as much as was in these studies, but there was this big hullabaloo that these fats aided weight loss and fat loss, but they were actually trans fats. These are a specific type of trans fat. It's in the name, like transbasenic acid and conjugated linoleic acid. They just happen to be trans fats that are made in the rumen of dairy cattle and probably other dairy animals as well, and that end up naturally in very small amounts within dairy products. So they're not just man-made, but we ingenious mammals that we are did discover a way to make fats saturated by basically trying to, but we call it hydrogenation. You're hydrogenating an unsaturated fat molecule, and you're forcing those double bonds to break down and become saturated again with hydrogen atoms, and that creates, in an ideal world, in a perfect practice, would not make a trans fat. It would make a saturated fat, but it is not a perfect process, and we end up with these kinks in them called trans kinks. This is the name is a little strange, but basically, most fats that are found in nature, most unsaturated fats, the kink in them is in a CIS formation. That's what is just most common, and that's what our bodies are used to. Unfortunately, this trans formation, our body is less used to. And when those end up in it as a result of this hydrogenation process, it has detrimental effects upon our body in the large amounts that we end up consuming them. Notably, it raises our LDL cholesterol, the bad type of cholesterol, and lowers the HDL cholesterol. So that's when we're talking about how dietary fat can affect your cholesterol levels, that's basically the worst way that it possibly could. Gives you a lot more bad cholesterol, decreases your good cholesterol.
Yeah, and so the reason that these fatty acid types matter is that you got to think about the fact that these fatty acids are going to be they don't just exist in this triglyceride. They're going to be taken into other tissues as fatty acids and joined to other molecules. So one of the problems with this trans fat thing is the fact, well, so the saturated fats, so if we think of something like coconut oil, right? Coconut oil, if anyone's come into contact with it, knows that it at room temperature, it's generally solid, right? The more solid a fat is, the more saturated it is. That's why fish oils and things like that, or vegetable oils are liquid. Those are polyunsaturated. So the point of us coming up with trans fat is that we were looking for a way to make shelf-stable products.
Right.
But the problem with it is that our cell membranes and our tissues started to incorporate supposedly what the tissues assumed were saturated fatty acids, but they weren't. They were these kind of obscure kinked fatty acids, which have now been basically shown to have caused a lot of problems health-wise, which is why I think I don't think you can even buy any products in the UK or in America with trans fat added.
I don't think so either, but the this I always I think is I don't know not ironic not funny just is but what fat have they replaced these trans fats with now in these processed foods?
Well,
Predominantly now it's palm oil.
that's right, yeah.
So palm oil is a I believe it's a C16 saturated fat. I don't remember the. Maybe it's palmitic acid. It probably is what it is. Now that I think put the names together. Palmitic acid is certainly a better fat replacement than trans fat. Trans fat, like I mentioned, is just a terrible fat for the body. But when we're looking at saturated fats, and saturated fats have enjoyed a renaissance recently in terms of health, we're not afraid of them like we used to, because we realize that they're not the end of the world. But when we're looking at them just individually, and rather than grouping their effects together, palmitic acid, this the fat that is dominant within palm oil, is probably the second worst fat that our body can take in, because it increases the LDL, and I think it has no effect on the LDL. So it's still not really a positive fat to be consuming in large amounts, and it's actually not a significant fat within most of the foods we eat. If you think about, you know, what our predominant sources of fat would have been in the past, it wouldn't have been palm oil. And most of the fats that are saturated are either composed of stearic acid, which is a C18 and is fairly beneficial, or, you know, C12 or C14, the lauric acid, or don't remember what the 14 is, but these all have slightly better effects on the body. And, you know, so saturated fat has rightfully been vindicated, but that doesn't mean that, you know, you should just go out and consume any saturated fat that you want. There are still fats that have better and worse effects upon our body. And palm oil, this replacement for trans fat, happens to be probably the worst of them. So all these products that you read and you're like, oh, it doesn't contain trans fats anymore, it's much better for me now. It's maybe a little bit better, but it's still honestly pretty bad. If you're looking at any processed food and thinking, hey, they made an improvement to this, it's healthy now, then you're thinking about your food wrong.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of a summary we'll talk about is really the application of this, but it's quite simply, right. Stay away from foods that have fats added into them. Rather, just eat foods that come in their most natural form. But right. But before we get on there, let's talk about, because I think this is more important in terms of an effect, is we talk about PUFAs, or polyunsaturated fatty acids. So many of you would have heard about polyunsaturated fatty acids, mainly in terms of the omega-3. So the omega-3 is what is generally called the kind of heart healthy or the brain healthy fatty acids that's predominantly found in fish. And the other polyunsaturated fatty acid is what is called omega-6. And the reason that these two are interesting is they are basically the precursors or the fatty acids which are part and parcel in the kind of inflammatory or anti-inflammatory pathways in the body. Again, it's also related to the fluidity of the cell membranes. So you can think of it in terms of the same way that saturated fat is more shelf stable, or sorry, is rigid. So saturated fat makes cell membranes more rigid, which is important in some cases. PUFAs can affect the cell membrane in the opposite way, which is important for things like different transporters, things like glucose transporters on the cell membranes and things like that.
Right.
So what is interesting about PUFAs, and we're going to use that term, it's easier to say, is that over the last number of years, because there has been this big push back against saturated fat, and this podcast is probably not going to be long enough for us to go into the debate about saturated fat directly. Maybe we could do a whole show on that in more detail. But
yeah, I'm sure we could.
But what's generally happened is that our diets have now become very high in omega 6 fats, not necessarily omega 3s, because what we've basically done is that we've taken foods that are that exist in nature, you know, anything from avocados to meat products, eggs, dairy, which have a generally good balance of saturated fats and monounsaturated and polyunsaturated, with a slightly good skew towards omega-3, and have replaced them with for instance, palm oil, and also vegetable oils like sunflower oil, canola, rapeseed, safflower, and things like that. And what is tricky about this is the fact that there's two things going on here. One is their effects on our inflammatory and anti-inflammatory pathways, but also in relation to their ability to be oxidized. So part of the difference in the saturation of the fat is how reactive they are to oxygen. So a saturated fat goes back to why we came up with trans fats, right? It's because they're shelf stable because they don't oxidize as well as polyunsaturated fatty acids. That's why, for instance, if you buy a fish oil, you have to keep it in a closed container, tight. It's normally a dark container, so it can't be affected by light and things like that, because they're easily oxidized.
Right. Yeah, exactly. They're more easily oxidized, and but the in particular the omega-3s are that much more prone to oxidation. We've learned that the omega-6s, not only are they easier to produce because the food sources of them are much more common. We're talking about nut and seed oils, and nuts and seeds are really much easier to grow in mass and then to refine down to just this refined oil than omega-3s are. There are not too many terrestrial variations of them, at least not foods that are high in omega-3s. We're talking about like flax seeds and chia seeds. You can press these seeds and get their oil, but it just isn't as economically efficient, and then it doesn't store as well. In addition, like especially these plant-based ones, you often see that they want to be not just kept in a dark place and tightly stored, but refrigerated just to slow down oxidation that much more. And you wouldn't really want that. You wouldn't want, as an industrial producer, you wouldn't want a bag of potato chips that you have to store in the fridge, because there's a lot less storage space in your grocery store's fridge than there is on every other aisle. It costs a lot more money to store something in the fridge versus just on the shelf. And then as a consumer, probably most consumers don't want to store their crisps in the fridge either. So we've learned to use a lot more omega-6s. And by we, I mean we as the human race, use omega-6s instead of omega-3s. And what that has done is it's pushed the number of omega-6s in our diet way high compared to what it would be if we did not have access to refined oils. And simultaneously, because we're eating these processed foods, and because these processed foods tend not to have very much omega-3s within them, the amount of omega-3 fats that we've eaten has dropped down to much lower levels than perhaps would have been common in our history. And that is kind of the source of this debate that we have about how important it is to get, like, how many omega-3s do you need? And beyond that, should you be limiting your omega-6s? Should you, what's the best way to improve this ratio? There are people who will say that, there's a hard and fast ratio that they base on some sort of, historical pseudoscience or something. Right. We have no idea what the ratio would be in a natural man, because we don't have access to that. We don't have access to a perfect historical diet record, nor should we expect that it would be the same in place to place. Obviously, humans that live near oceans are going to have a lot higher access to omega-3s than those that do not. But that doesn't mean that they're going to be healthier. The best thing that I can say is that the goal is to eat more omega-3s and eat less omega-6s. Don't worry as much about the ratio. Just worry about trying to shift that, just trying to shift it. If you eat more omega-3s and you eat less omega-6s, predominantly by eating less processed foods, then you're going to improve that ratio. naturally.
Yeah, but what isn't so helpful is to keep the same diet that you do, but just supplement with omega-3s. So I think Brian would probably agree that the best way to get this so-called balance right is to remove the processed omega-6 fats from right. your diet, rather than trying to skew it by, for instance, taking tablespoons of fish oil every day.
Right.
Because I mean, you know, briefly, the reason that these things are important is that it goes into the balance of what is biochemically going on in the body. So these omega-3 fatty acids, as you're probably well aware, have been shown to improve things like cognition, are important for brain function, important for cell membranes. The names of them that you're going to come across in terms of the omega-3s are the ALA, EPA, and DHA. And, you know, these are important for these pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory pathways. And so we need these as a nutrient in the diet. And, you know, we're looking at sources that come from nature. So things like fish, fatty fish, there is some omega-3 in well-raised pastured meat products. You're going to find them in nuts and seeds and also avocado and things like that. So whole food sources. But as we said, the problem is that we get so much omega-6 from added oils to products. So again, with all this sort of stuff, you know, and it's not sexy, but really the more you can cut out processed foods from your diet and eat foods that actually come in their natural form, this sort of stuff is going to balance out automatically for you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You can't just supplement with omega-3s. I mean, you can, but really at that point, you're making such a small difference, because the reality is we do need significantly more omega-6s than we need omega-3s. And within ourselves, we have significantly more omega-6s just naturally, and we want that ratio. You know, if you pushed your omega-3s within your cell membranes past this, you know, kind of good point, it becomes detrimental. Inflammation, you know, it gets a bad rap, but it is a necessary process. And we want inflammation. We want to be able to use inflammation to, you know, to heal. We need it to improve when we're training. You know, training, getting stronger is inflammation driven. So we need it. But you're going to be better off, you know, again, with the aim of trying to improve this ratio. Yeah, you will be better off reducing these omega-6s rather than just throwing more omega-3s on top.
So a quick thing is that, so our predominant source of omega-3s for in an omnivore's diet is going to mainly be from fatty fish.
Marine
products, basically. We do find omega-3s in plant sources, but there's an interesting thing is that, so the two main omega-3s that are so-called most useful are the EPA and DHA,
right. Which is fine. These are the pre-converted very long chain omega-3s.
Yeah, we have a shorter chained omega-3 which you find called ALA, and ALA can be converted into EPA, and EPA can then be converted to DHA. I believe if that's correct. Mm-hmm. But what we see in the literature is the fact that the conversion rate for ALA to EPA, so the conversion of plant-sourced omega-3 to these EPA and DHA, is incredibly poor. We're looking at about, you know, I think it's something as low as 9% or something. So the reason that I'm bringing this up is that both Brian and I don't believe that it's it would be worth your while if you're looking at, say you're a vegetarian vegan and you're looking for a source of omega-3, we don't believe it would be wise to predominantly try and get your omega-3s from something like flaxseed. And the reason being is that the conversion of ALA in the flaxseed to the EPA, DHA is incredibly low and could be even lower depending on your genetics. So right. What we'd rather recommend is by all means eat the chia and the flax seeds and things like that for, you know, the sake of eating them and enjoying them in your diet. But we would recommend that if you are needing to increase omega-3s in your diet, then I would look at a vegan source of EPA, DHA. And there's a lot of products coming out now which are algae-based products. So that's something that I've recommended to some of my clients who are so to all my clients who are vegan is to look at a vegan supplement for these, not to rely on chia seeds and flax seeds, because I don't believe that you're going to get anywhere near the rate of conversion that would be health beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, as I make the same recommendation to vegan clients. I mean, the reality is if you're vegan, there are some things that you're just going to have to supplement. Most vegans now are aware of vitamin B12. It's a necessary nutrient or an essential nutrient, and it's only found in animal products. So if you are going to be vegan, you need to consume vitamin B12. And I would say it's the same thing with these preformed long chain omega-3 fats. You're going to need them in your diet. They are essential. You can get them from plants, but it's just so inefficient. I mean, if you think that, you know, a tablespoon of chia seeds, I think, has maybe 2 grams of ALA, if you have a tremendous ability to convert that into EPA, you're still only going to get about 200 milligrams out of that, which is about 1/5 of the usually recommended amount for a day. So yeah, that means 5 tablespoons of chia seeds. And that is a lot of chia seed to eat. At that point, if you're eating 5 tablespoons every day, then you are supplementing already. You're just supplementing with chia seeds. So yeah, Go out, buy an algae oil supplement or, you know, I think they're probably all algae oils, because algae oil, algae is where the fish themselves are getting the EPA and DHA, or the EPA, and then they convert to DHA. But go out and buy one of these supplements and use it. It's not going to kill you if you don't, but there have been studies that have shown that vegans and vegetarians, but predominantly vegans, have lower levels of omega-3s within their cell membranes than omnivores do. And we're not looking at omnivores that are necessarily supplementing with fish oil. You know, this is taken from the general population who are going to have general habits. It's just saying that, you know, without anything else being different, an omnivore tends to have higher levels of omega-3. And that is going to have a positive effect on their health, you know, ignoring anything else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, oh, just a quick one. So one of the reasons why we worry about the oxidation of PUFAs is the fact, again, it comes into play in terms of your tissues are incorporating these fatty acids. So we don't want our tissues to incorporate oxidized fatty acids, which is also why it appears that for people who are consuming a very high PUFA diet, so that's predominantly coming from frying your foods in vegetable oils and also, you know, processed foods having high amounts of PUFAs, is that's where even in themselves, apart from the pro-inflammatory effects, is that there is a more chance of having these oxidized fatty acids come into the system.
Right. I do want to clarify, though, because this idea of oxidized fats being dominant in our diet has gained a little bit of steam recently. You will see a lot of internet articles about, you know, oxidized fats. It is something to be aware of, but you shouldn't go around believing that all of these fats that you're eating are probably oxidized. Fat changes when it oxidizes, and it not only does it become worse for us, but it also changes in its tangible properties or its you know, discernible properties. It will smell different. One reason why, for example, when meat goes bad, one reason why it smells bad is because the fat has gone rancid in it. And so you get this very physical phenomena that tells you, hey, this isn't good to eat anymore. And even when that fat is separated from whatever it was a part of, it's the same thing. Fat develops off smells as it oxidizes. It develops off tastes. It doesn't taste as pleasant. So the fact is, fat in our diet, it's not predominantly oxidized. Most fats that we consume are not oxidized, even if they're PUFAs. But, you know, if you ever open up, maybe you have a jar of oil, then you smell it and it smells a little off, that is a good indication that it has oxidized. And I will also say that contrary to what is often espoused, saturated fats do also oxidize over time. They are not immune to the process. Mm-hmm. Every fat will eventually go bad. Saturated fats are a little bit slower, but honestly, you should be smelling your food before you're eating it. If it smells off, if it smells different than normal, then chances are there has been some chemical change within it. And that chemical change is probably not beneficial unless you are talking about cheese or wine or some other fermented food.
Okay. Right. Should we quickly talk about medium chain triglycerides?
MCT? Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Another very popular topic of late, or I guess maybe for the last 20, 25 years, the idea of these medium chain triglycerides. What the hypothesis behind them is, and this is factual, this little pit right here, medium chain triglycerides, unlike long chain triglycerides, which is the dominant fat within our diet, most of the fats that we eat are 12 or more carbons long, 14 or more carbons long, kind of this 12 to 18 range, those require transportation across the mitochondrial membrane. So whenever we're burning fat, we do it within the mitochondria. That's where all the mechanisms, all the machinery to drive aerobic oxidation lives, within the mitochondria. But the long chains are just, they're too big. They can't get across that membrane without help. And so we have shuttles like L-carnitine that help it get across. Medium chain triglycerides, on the other hand, are small enough that they can cross that membrane without the help of anything. And so they are burned more easily. They don't have the same limitations that the long chain ones have. So this led, that's the factual part. That's the part that it's just scientific truth. The part that it starts to get a little wonky around is that there's the idea that because medium chain triglycerides are easier for our bodies to burn, that makes them a better source of fuel. And like, for example, a good source of weight loss, because the idea is we would consume a lot of these medium chain triglycerides and our body burns them easily and therefore doesn't store them. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of evidence that either of those are true, at least not in a way that would be beneficial for the average person. Like, for example, for weight loss, and then I'll let you address the exercise portion. But when we're talking about weight loss, most of the trials that have shown any benefit to medium chain triglycerides have used them in extraordinarily high amounts. So we're talking like 8 to 10 grams a day. And of a very specific type of medium chain triglyceride, either the 8 or the 10 carbon long ones, which are not common in our diet, not even in coconut oil. These in coconut oil, they comprise about 5% of all the fat within the oil, which is not a lot. That's the food that's highest in them. Every other food is going to have that much less of them. To consume, you know, if you were to consume coconut oil to get to 8 to 10 grams, we're talking about eating, you know, what is that? That's like 150 or 160 to 200 grams of coconut oil per day, which is a ton of calories. That's
near impossible, I would think.
Right. I will say that if you're consuming that much coconut oil, in the idea that you're going to lose weight because you're going to get these medium chain triglycerides, then you are shooting yourself in the foot.
Yes, you've jumped the shark on that one.
It is not, eating that many calories is not going to be beneficial, even if you happen to get medium chain triglycerides with it. The studies were able to overcome this because they were using what you would call functional foods. They were basically making specialized meals that had these fats incorporated in them. And as a result, people were eating their normal everyday diets. They just happened to have some fat in the diet replaced with medium chain triglycerides. And if we were able to do that with normal foods, then there might be a little bit of hope that medium chain triglycerides could, you know, play a meaningful role in weight loss in the future. But really, it's going to be pretty difficult for the industry to produce a solution like that, because they're fairly tasteless, medium chain triglycerides. They're not, they don't bring pleasure in the same way that oils and butter do. So they don't really add anything to a meal. And again, if you're spreading, like even if they made a butter-like spread made of medium chain triglycerides, if you're spreading your piece of toast with that, then again, you're just really, all you're doing is consuming extra calories. There might be better ways to lose weight. I should also note that none of the studies showed dramatic weight loss. We're talking like a small additional amount, which is really all that any supplement ever does in any weight loss study. It's never a magic bullet. But particularly with medium chain triglycerides, it didn't even appear to be even remotely magic bullets. It was just a small additional aid. And there are certainly better ways to increase your weight loss by, 1%.
Mm. Yeah, like just not eating extra fat in the first place.
Right.
So, I mean, in terms of exercise, I won't go into detail, but basically we haven't seen any data that consuming MCTs is boosting performance. Consuming fat increases fat oxidation, but that doesn't mean that you're oxidizing more body fat. Certainly during exercise, that's not really helping. I mean, the reason that MCTs are looked at as a potential ergogenic aid is the fact that they bypass the lymphatic system, so they go straight to the portal vein, and that's why you can metabolize them much quicker. So this is why the thought that you could consume MCTs before performance and have this extra fat, this extra energy source along the side. But unfortunately, they haven't shown to be beneficial in that case. And also, right, they because of this rate of digestion, it actually can cause gastrointestinal distress. And a lot of people who have experimented with either a lot of coconut oil or pure MCT oil know that it can vary from about a tablespoon upwards can, make you run to the loo in about half an hour. So
that might increase your performance.
exactly. Now,
it kind of runs into the same problem that we talked about earlier, which is that we have limited fat transporters. MCTs, like anything else, they need to be carried through the blood with a transporter, and you have a limited number of them. It doesn't matter if your transporters are fully saturated with medium chain triglycerides or with long chain triglycerides. The fact of the matter is that's the limitation there, not how fast they're getting across the mitochondrial membrane. That might be a very minor limitation that is interesting in an academic sense. But the major limitation we're talking about that is affecting them is they're just not going to be transported. They can't be transported in any greater amount than any other type of fat. So you're hitting your head against the exact same brick wall that you would be with any other fat molecule when it comes to performance.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we can't with the body, we can't just like mainline energy sources into our blood and assume that that just is going to increase the capacity to burn it. It doesn't quite work that way. So now, the MCTs have became very popular with the kind of the bulletproof coffee, and that is, people putting fat, probably butter and MCT oil in their coffee to have that as instead of a breakfast. And just very quickly, so what is interesting about fat is the fact that itself does not promote the oxidization of itself. Well, that's a terrible sentence. What I mean,
I think any sentence that you throw to itself can qualify for that.
What I mean is that what is amazing, and many people don't realize this, is that when you consume carbohydrate, your body upregulates the metabolism of carbohydrate and lowers the metabolism of fat. The same thing actually happens with protein. When you consume a lot of protein, the body upregulates protein metabolism. Unfortunately, when you consume a lot of fat, it doesn't actually affect the rate of fat metabolism, meaning that if you take a massive bolus of fat, you don't suddenly start burning more fat at a higher rate. It doesn't stimulate its own metabolism. This is exactly why, for instance, if you overfeed someone on protein, they potentially gain less fat mass. The same thing with carbohydrate. If you overfeed people with carbohydrate, they actually put on less fat mass than if you overfeed them with fat. So what this is where people kind of get it wrong, is that no doubt that if you consume a cup of coffee in the morning and not eat anything else, and it contains MCT oil, there would be a case that the MCT oil will hit the liver quickly and give you a short burst of energy, and the effect of having caffeine on an empty stomach is also going to make you feel buzzy. By consuming a tablespoon of butter, or let's say just 30 grams of butter melted into coffee, is not going to do anything more for your metabolism other than slow gastric emptying because of the fat in the stomach, give you a hit of caffeine because you're not blunting the caffeine entering the system by having a larger meal. And unfortunately, you're just going to get about 290 something calories of 290 calories, but with almost zero nutrition.
Right.
So I'm not going to labor the point, but if you feel bulletproof coffee can be useful if you are wanting to restrict energy, and by having a cup of coffee with some butter in it stops you from having a very calorie dense breakfast, and that plays into energy balance at the end of the day, then by all means. But what you got to understand is that the weight loss, so-called weight loss effect of a bulletproof coffee, is not because you are eating more fat and then burning more fat. It doesn't work that way. But I'm not going to go into much more on that. But do whatever you want. But just understand that that fat does not stimulate its own oxidation. If your diet is high in fat, you're going to be burning more fat than carbohydrate. Why? Because you're eating more fat. That doesn't necessarily mean you're burning more body fat. It just means that you're burning what is the greater proportion of your diet.
Yeah, your body will burn the fuel that you give to it. If you give it only fat to burn, you're not going to die. You're just going to burn that fat. If you give it only carbohydrates, it's going to burn more carbohydrates. As Tom said, you're not going to upregulate your adipose, the oxidation of adipose tissue, just because you eat a lot of fat. Your body will upregulate carbohydrates, because carbohydrates we have limited storage capacity for, and storing them as fat is calorically expensive or energetically expensive. Same thing with protein. You can't just fold all the protein that you consume in your diet into your muscles. Certainly getting into shape would be a lot easier if you could. Instead, you have to either oxidize it or excrete it. So it makes sense why our body would upregulate for carbohydrate and protein the oxidation of these molecules. It's a, for lack of a better word, a defense mechanism. It helps us maintain healthy body chemistry. But for fat, there's no need, because fat's already in a form that we can easily store. If we have too much, it doesn't need to oxidize it. It can just put it in our belly.
Yeah. So you got to realize that is that, like I said right at the beginning, the fat that you have on your toast is a triglyceride. When we consume it, we break it into fatty acids and the glycerol backbone. Those fatty acids can be transported and then put back into adipose tissue as the fatty acids that you just consumed. This is also why, if, for instance, if you were to eat pork and it's been fed on acorns, it tastes really good because the fatty acids from the acorns make it into the fat of the animal. That's why grass-fed, pasture-raised animals have a yellower, tastier fat than, you know, grain-fed.
So gastronomical adventure there, whole world of interesting side effects about how fat and diet affects the taste of the foods we eat. But that's a completely different discussion.
That's right. But what I'm going to do, because I do want to cover this, because I'm sure people are going to ask about this, is I want to just run. Now, I've got some bullet points here, and I'm going to go run really quick because we're in an hour already, of a little bit about cholesterol, LDL, and HDL. So I'm not going to do it all, but I'm just going to run through so you can people can kind of understand, because it should answer a few questions. So when we talk about cholesterol in the general media, cholesterol is really, people are talking about the LDL, HDL lipoproteins, but cholesterol itself, cholesterol is actually a molecule. It's a kind of waxy substance that your body, your liver produces. About 85% of the cholesterol in your body is produced in the liver, and about 15% of it comes from what you eat. Now, cholesterol itself is incredibly important for things like cell membranes. It's a precursor to hormones like pregnenolone. Progesterone is produced from that. Cortisol comes from that. Aldosterone, which is related to blood pressure and mineral balance. Testosterone and your sex hormones, things that regulate libido, muscle mass. Testosterone gets modified to estradiol, and estradiol goes to estrogen. This is a whole other thing we could probably talk about. But basically, cholesterol is a precursor to steroid hormones. It is also precursor to vitamin D. A lot of people don't realize, but vitamin D is actually a hormone, though we call it a vitamin. So when the sunlight is hitting the skin, it's actually being combined with cholesterol and forms vitamin D.
Tapping the power of the sun to make our hormone.
Exactly. And that's very important for things like calcium metabolism, bone health, blood sugar regulation, and the immune system. cholesterol is also a limiting factor in brain cells, need for synapse creation. This is also why, if you look at something, if you look at the side effects of statins, so statins are a drug that will lower or inhibit the body from producing cholesterol. If you actually look at the side effects of statins, they're pretty horrific. So there are cases where obviously people are requiring something like an intervention like that. But what you got to understand is that one, cholesterol is an essential nutrient in the body. The other thing is that, importantly in terms of just general knowledge, is that there isn't any connection between the amount of cholesterol you eat and the cholesterol you find in your blood. 30% of the population can increase their lipoprotein, this HDL amount, by eating more cholesterol. But you've got to think of it like this, is that if you eat a huge amount of eggs, your body just produces less cholesterol. If you stop eating all those eggs, your body will produce cholesterol again. So again, like 85% of the cholesterol that's in your blood is coming from your liver. It's not coming from your diet. So this brings me to what they call LDL and HDL. So this is what, when you go to the doctor and you ask for your cholesterol panel or your lipid profile, this is what is generally referred to as cholesterol, these things. So very quickly, when you consume fat, your intestines package it up with cholesterol that your liver produces, and packages up the triglycerides and also the fat soluble nutrients like vitamin A, D, E, K, and coenzyme 10, Q10, into something called chylomicrons. And basically, these chylomicrons travel from the intestines through the blood, to the blood, sorry, through the lymphatic system, and then they make their way to the liver, where a receptor picks them up called the LDL. And then the liver repackages these things and repackages them as cholesterol and fat-soluble nutrients into something called very low-density lipoproteins. And these are the VLDLs, and these get sent out into the blood. I'm trying to make this sound very flowy, but I'm reading my notes here. But but I want to do this because I think it's going to help people, because people get a little can get a little confused. So the VLDL now that gets taken from the liver, this is what delivers the cholesterol and fat and the vitamins to other tissues, right? In the same way the chylomicrons do. So think of it like this: you consume fat. They become chylomicrons. These chylomicrons go through the lymphatic system to the tissues, and the remnants from these chylomicrons, so the bits that are left after tissues have taken the various bits off them, they go back to the liver. The liver then packages more cholesterol and fat-soluble nutrients onto them, and they become VLDLs, and they get sent out into the blood. The tissues then take bits and pieces off these VLDLs, and these remnants of these now go back to the liver again, and they become something called LDL, right? Now, the VLDL and LDL mean very low-density lipoprotein and low-density lipoprotein. And the reason that this is where it becomes important is that the composition of these lipoprotein molecules is affected by the diet, and it goes back to these polyunsaturated fatty acids, because what can happen is that these LDLs that are floating around in our bloodstream can be oxidized depending on how well they are packaged together. So what you've got to think about is that as your body uses or takes off the various molecules off this lipoprotein that is traveling around, the surface areas of this lipoprotein changes, and this can be oxidized. And it's this oxidization of the LDL which can cause issues with the blood vessels, because it can carry or interface with blood vessels and cause an inflammatory response, which then causes a cascade of things which will cause, funny enough, cholesterol to come and be used to patch up the blood vessels that's been damaged. Now, there's something called HDL, which is called high-density lipoprotein, and this is basically produced by the liver. And HDL is interesting because it basically does two things. It can take cholesterol from tissues and transport it around back to the liver, but also it can bump into these LDL particles and exchange cholesterol for fatty acids. So, very, very briefly, it is thought or understood that it is this oxidized LDL that contributes to atherosclerosis, and the best means to go about combating this is not to do a low-fat diet, but actually to try and increase the amounts of fresh foods that you eat, because that's going to improve your antioxidant capacity. So we want to improve the balance between oxidation and antioxidation in the body. As we mentioned already, there's a way that you can do this by reducing polyunsaturated intake. And interesting things like you can increase the LDL receptors. And there's some thought that something like curcumin, but also thyroid hormone can play into this. So in a general sense, is that the when we eat things like saturated fat, we increase the ratio of HDL to LDL. But funny enough, the LDL number remains the same. But what happens is that we actually pack more onto these LDL particles, which actually prevents them from being oxidized. So what's interesting, and more data is coming out, is actually the quality of our diet, and that includes not going super low fat, is actually heart healthy, because what we're doing is we're making the LDL particles large and buoyant with fatty acids and cholesterol, and we're not allowing them to basically become small and dense and easily oxidized. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that was at all helpful to anybody, I don't know. But there is what I will do is I will link to a couple of great websites which go into a lot of detail on this, which I think would be interesting for people. So I'll put that in the actual page. Okay.
All right. So what can we take home from all of this?
I don't know, Brian. What can we take home from all this?
Well, in my mind, there's two take-home points, two ideas here. And then we can kind of wax on about them, and you can add what if you have any further ideas. But the first is that when we're eating fat, just with any other aspect of our diet, it's better to get it from a whole source, and rather than get it from a refined source. You know, like we're all familiar with the idea that you shouldn't add refined sugars to your diet, you know, that those aren't positive. And yet, you know, we don't seem to apply the same rule to refined fats. But it should be the same. If your fat is coming from just added oils, you know, if you're just, you know, if you're sauteing some vegetables and you pour in, you know, three times as much oil as you need to saute them, that's added fat, and it's not serving any beneficial purpose. So that's the first basic idea that I think is important to come away from all of this. And the other one is don't focus on the fat calories themselves. Fat is already much more energetically dense than carbohydrate or protein is. And if you focus on trying to get enough fat, you are almost guaranteed to overshoot how much you actually need or should be getting. On the other hand, if you allow fat to come into your diet in just a natural way, you eat the foods that you eat, and you happen to have some nuts, and you know, you saute some vegetables later on, and you use a little bit of oil to do that, and you have an avocado on a salad, you know, and you have a cut of meat, and that meat's going to have some fat on it, chances are you're going to end up in this natural range of how much fat your body is going to be happy on.
Yeah, certainly. And I think as well as what you will find is that if you actually create a meal out of foods that are fatty, so, you know, many people talk about the Mediterranean diet, which includes olive oil and basically products that are going to have a medium amount of fat, so not highly fatty meats, but maybe lamb and things like that, and fatty fish, is that you'll find that these meals are very satiating in themselves. So there, it's as Brian says, it is, I don't see, apart from the omega-3, as we mentioned earlier, in terms of supplementation, right, I don't see any reason for someone to go out of their way to try and hit a fat intake as a goal. If you are creating a meal out of avocados, if you're having some nuts as a snack, if you're having lean meats, but when I mean lean, I don't mean all the fat is cut off, but rather not a massive sirloin steak with a 3-centimeter fat rind running down the side, then you're going to find that that meal is going to satiate you anyway, that you're not going to overeat, but also you're going to get this really good balance of fats. You know, one of the things that people forget is fat and sugar is highly palatable. This is the reason why everybody is overweight, is because, not because of the sugar and not because of the fat, but most likely because of the fat and the sugar combined. Easy way to test this is, what's easier to eat, a bowl of popcorn without anything on it or a bowl of popcorn with butter and salt? Same with white potatoes. White potatoes are, I think, the highest satiating food that exists. But if you put butter on white potatoes, you can keep going. So be aware as well that fat generally, in terms of added fat, is not a great source of nutrition. So certainly something like nuts.
More satiation, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and so certainly things like nuts and avocados and things, and also olive oil. And olive oil has things like polyphenols and things like that, which is health promoting. But eating butter, because you think that butter, even if it's grass-fed, is a good source of vitamins and things like that, that's really misguided. If you want to have butter, have it for flavor, but don't add butter to your diet thinking that you're going to be making yourself healthy. You've got this calorie allotment if you're thinking about this sort of thing. You know, why don't you fill that calorie allotment up with foods that contain high micronutrition? So, for instance, a lot of quite successful dietary protocols use things like avocado and nuts as the primary means of getting your fat. And I think that's a pretty good idea. I just don't see any reason for adding fat to meals other than for the pleasure of eating, which is, you know, that's one of the reasons that we eat foods. So do that. But don't go out of your way to add fats thinking that it's going to help you burn more fat. It doesn't. Right. All it does is it means that you have to burn that fat that you've added. And as Brian said, it's very, very easy to overshoot your calories if that's, you're so inclined to count them at the time, by fat, because it's so easy to consume in large amounts.
Yeah, and it's just so energetically dense, and it's as I mentioned earlier, it's not water soluble, so it tends to not just be energetically dense, but physically dense. A pat of butter, just one tablespoon is 100 calories. Not a tablespoon. Yeah, yes, a tablespoon.
Yeah, like 15 grams or so. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, but a tablespoon of sugar is, that's only like 45 calories. It's less than half the amount. Not that you should add a tablespoon of sugar to just anything either. But the idea is that it's very easy to overconsume when you're not, you know, paying attention to where the fat in your diet's coming from. It's difficult to overconsume if it's in a natural form. Like, there's only so many avocados you can eat. Nuts, I can gorge myself on.
Sure. Which is definitely something to be careful of.
Right. But if you're talking about like adding fats, like if you go out to a restaurant, you know, and they make a delicious meal for you, you don't want to see what the calorie count is on that. They're not concerned for your health. That's not what they're selling you. They're not selling you, most restaurants anymore aren't selling you, you know, the idea of health. They're selling you a delicious meal prepared by, you know, a talented chef. And they're going to throw as much butter and oil and sugar, certainly, into those meals as is necessary to make them as tasty as possible. And it's going to be a lot. It's going to be way more than you would ever anticipate or would ever use at home. And if you did use that at home, then, you know, you will realize, if you're bothering to count, you'll realize just how easy it is. If you're focusing on putting fat into foods, you'll realize how easy it is to completely blow through whatever targets you have set.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, in terms of some practicalities on this, is we will do God willing, a podcast on a ketogenic diet. So we'll look at that specifically. We're also going to do a podcast on weight loss for the athlete. We'll look at that. But one of the things I recommend as a practice to my clients is that if they're wanting say it's a day that they're not doing much activity, and they're on a protocol where they're trying to either maintain weight or lose weight. What I tend to do is to have a bit of a choice between the type of meals that you have. So if you're wanting a meal that is going to have particularly more fat in it, so butter with your steaks and things like that, then I would reduce the carbohydrate down on that meal. So for instance, I wouldn't necessarily have a steak with a whole boat of potato and butter. I would probably reduce the carbohydrates down a little bit, and then you can increase the fats, and vice versa. It's not to say that you can't mix fats and carbohydrates together, but just in terms of an easy way to balance your energy, that if you're going to have a day where you want to have a lower carb day because you're not doing so much activity, then by all means have the avocados and the nuts and the butters and things like that. The other thing to think about as well is that, I'm a big fan of being in the kitchen, and there is, if you're cooking a steak and you want to finish it off in the pan with some garlic and rosemary and things like that with a big knob of butter, then what you can do is realize that you don't have to consume the whole thing of butter. So I'll throw a good, tablespoon of butter in the pan when I'm finishing my steak off, and then serve the steak with all that flavor that you've cooked into it. But you don't have to pour over the 30 grams of butter onto the plate. Use the butter for flavor. It's the same thing with fatty cuts of meat. By all means, make your food with the fatty cuts of meat and things like that. But just be aware that you don't need to eat that fat. And the reason being is that you're not going to get loads of nutrition from that fat. And that's the main thing I want to push on, that is that by consuming fat just for the sake of consuming fat is not going to increase your nutrition. You can do that in a much better way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I recommend a little different than what you mentioned, but similar in some ways for my clients, which is basically on rest days, I assign, certain targets based on rest days. And then based on exercise, I will increase those targets. But the predominant thing that my athletes will be increasing is carbohydrate. So fat content stays relatively similar day to day. Certainly I allot a little bit more fat on days when it's a high exercise. I actually do it, based on how much exercise in a day. But the idea is, fat's going to stay pretty consistent day to day. Carbohydrates is what is really changing a lot. So once you find out about how much fat, is going to be satiating, how much is going to be realistic for you to be able to consume in a day without changing your dietary habits so significantly that it's going to be hard to maintain or adhere to the diet, then, work with that. And the detail work that's going to be changing is carbohydrates, not the fat.
Yeah, good. Let's see if there's anything else on our list here. I've got one here in terms of a supplement. So some people might have heard of something called L-carnitine. Brian actually mentioned it earlier in relation to transport. And that really is, it's basically a molecule that is part and parcel of the a transporter called CPT1 that transports fatty acids across the mitochondrial membrane. And the thought was, well, if you're consuming L-carnitine, then you can increase these transporters. But the data on that is really poor. I've lost it on the page here. But basically, they've looked at supplement. Oh, here we are. So some of the studies that have come out have looked at supplementing 100 days with 3 grams of L-carnitine, and it increased the muscle content of carnitine to 10%. One study looked at 168 days of supplementation with 1.4 grams of carnitine, and this increased it to 21%. And after this time, there was some sparing of muscle glycogen, but we're looking at 168 days of 3 grams of carnitine to produce a small increase in VO2 max and glycogen.
Almost half a year of taking a tremendously large amount of an expensive supplement just to get a very minor boost.
It really isn't worth it. Again, in terms of increasing your ability to metabolize fat, this is predominantly going to come from your training, your endurance mm-hmm. training and things like that, which we'll talk about in terms of the training effect. The only other thing I've got here is fat burners. We'll probably talk about more of this in terms of the weight loss, but in general, fat burners are mainly caffeine, and it's really not going to be increasing your ability to burn fat is at all. Like I said right at the beginning, you know, at rest we're burning 0.1 grams of fat per minute. If you take a fat burner and increase that like 0.2 grams per minute, all you're going to feel is very hot, and it's not going to make much difference. You might as well just manage your meals better, stop putting so much butter in your coffee, and you'll probably burn a lot more fat. And just think of this, folks, you know, say you have a choice between having a cup of coffee or having a cup of coffee with butter in it. Just by taking out the butter from your coffee, you've saved yourself roughly 150 calories like that without even thinking.
Right.
So, you know, this is where you're gonna find the increase in your goals, not by eating more fat to burn more fat.
Right. And we're equal opportunity. I mean, the same thing can be applied to drinking a soda. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Switch your soda to something that doesn't have calories, whether a diet soda or, you know, sparkling water or just regular water. That's calories that you're saving. You know, it doesn't the soda doesn't add any nutrition. The butter or cream or whatever in your coffee doesn't add any nutrition. If it's something that brings pleasure to you and, you know, weight loss is not your goal there. Or maybe weight loss is, but you've got other means of controlling your diet, then go for it. Just don't add these into your diet thinking that this is a great way to lose weight. It's not.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Like, I mean, really, you could summarize it as just don't add things into your diet. You know, mm-hmm. it's just not worth it. You know, Brian and I, you know, despite the amount of science we know, all of it comes down to literally eat real food. Like, it's not sexy, but I promise you guys, like,
you give away our secrets, Tom.
I promise you, if you just eat food that comes in its natural form, you're gonna hit a lot of the targets. I mean, Brian's written a book on vitamins, which is great, and we'll talk about that in a whole show, but just eat real food, and in some cases supplement with something like omega-3 fish oil or algae oil, and then that's going to get you the 99% of the way. And even in terms of high performance, it's about eating whole foods in the right mm-hmm. amount that is going to support your training. You know, all of the podcasts that we've done now, this triptych, protein, carbohydrates, and fats, you know, the overarching thing is really find the whole foods to eat these, have a diversity of foods, mm-hmm. and eat the right amount to support your goals, whether it is performance or weight loss. But you will find that if you focus on choosing whole, fresh foods, your health and your performance and your body composition are actually going to come into play pretty easily.
Yeah, and there's nothing magic about it. You know, I want to be clear on that, because I feel like there's often a dichotomy where, you know, there's dietitians and, you know, some nutritional professionals saying, you know, just giving a very basic scientific breakdown of it. And then there's, you know, kind of this other side of this, I sometimes call them armchair nutritionists, people who have an interest in nutrition, maybe blog about it, which I realize can describe both Tom and myself. But, you know, the idea like, oh, just eat whole foods. I guess there's a lot of kind of nature worship kind of pseudoscience surrounding the idea of a whole food diet. That's not what Tom and I, you know, I'm not suggesting that you buy into this idea that being natural by in and of itself is somehow, you know, always better than anything that is man-made. It's just, in this case, you know, we can give you the just the basic scientific reasons of why it is. And it comes down a lot to that It's just, it's less concentrated for sources of calories and more concentrated in nutrients. You know, and you can get all these nutrients from a pill if you want, outside of the calories. I wouldn't recommend getting all your calories in pill form. Be a lot of pills. But there's no need to. There's no need to because we, you know, probably everybody listening to this podcast has access to fresh foods, and it's going to be both cheaper and more pleasurable in the end to just eat these whole foods. You know, they don't need to be organic. They don't need to necessarily be raised in any special way. Certainly, you know, as we talked about earlier, there can be some benefits taste-wise, and we can, you know, it's a whole nother discussion to go into kind of this conventional versus organic debate, but it doesn't need to be anything special. Just a tomato is going to have nutrients and it's not very calorie dense. And if you eat a lot of tomatoes in your diet, you're not going to have a lot of room for other spare calories. If you eat a lot of potato chips in your diet, those are very calorically dense. It's going to be very hard to eat enough food to feel satiated and get enough nutrition from them in order to actually meet your goals. So there's nothing magic. It's just eating whole foods is by the way that they are, satiating and spares you calories while giving you the other nutrients that you need.
Exactly. Yeah. So though this has taken us nearly a year to produce 3 podcasts.
Yes. Squad goal for 2018 is 4. No, hopefully we'll do many more than 4.
Yeah. We hope that you have enjoyed our rambling and our attempt to have to convey a good message with these three podcasts. What we really want from you guys now is to start getting some questions and some feedback so that we can start answering some questions specifically. You know, either we can include them in the next podcast. Or we can do a kind of ask us anything. So
we could even, you know, make entire podcasts based on questions have enough room for that.
Definitely.
Speaking of that, I mean, Tom and I, at least we haven't discussed what the next topic will be. And we'll come up with one, but it would be great if people actually came on to, you know, Facebook or onto Climb's High site, or maybe actually we might not have comments enabled there, but you can leave comments on my Facebook page, Climbing Nutrition Facebook page, or the Climbing Nutrition website, and let us know what you're interested in, because we would, you know, we like talking about science, but it'll be that much better if we can talk about the science that you're interested in as it relates to climbing.
Exactly. And also, if you give us something specific that we can be more narrow on, we'll probably be able to be better with our time management.
Rumor has it we might be able to stay under an hour, and dare I say under 45 or even 30 minutes. I don't know. It depends on the topic. Exactly. We've been a little too much off with each of the macronutrients just because they're such a giant topic.
Yeah,
they are. But hopefully we'll be narrower in the future.
It's certainly been, you know, we've enjoyed looking at this, but yeah, if you were to look at our pages of notes about what we would have liked to speak about and how much detail, you know, it takes us a lot of work to try and just be vague and summarize-y with this. So if you want us to really delve into answering a question about, I don't know, polyunsaturated fatty acids and their effect on inflammation and inflammation on the training effect, you know, this is what we would actually be excited about. You know, we're not saying that we don't want to talk about stuff. We want to talk about stuff. So if you want us to do a whole podcast on the inflammatory response in the body, then we'll do that, you know, by all means. So it's very much over to you guys now. And go to Climbing Nutrition .com, or probably best would be the Facebook page, Brian's Climbing Nutrition Facebook page. Leave comments there.
Yeah, a little easier to track.
Yeah.
Tom, anyway.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, then we can really start geeking out on stuff if people want us to geek out on stuff. Yeah, but thanks so much. I'll say thank you to Brian for starting this project with me.
Oh, it's been great, Tom. I've really enjoyed this. Yeah, it's been a great 2017. 3 episodes, and yeah, hopefully that many and more next year.
Yeah.
A strong 2018 for ClimbSci.
Yeah, I think so. And we're going to get some guests on. We've got pages of stuff we want to do as ideas, but yeah, we'll see how it's going. So
exactly.
So yeah, so I will say thank you so much to everyone for listening. My name is Tom Herbert. You can find me at useful.coach, where I put bits and pieces and I have my coaching practice.
And I'm Brian Rigby. You can find me at climbingnutrition.com and also on Facebook at the /climbingnutrition. Name is basically as it says, I write about nutrition for climbing.
There we go. And I try and be useful. Thanks so much. And we will hear you, or we'll sort of hear you. You will hear us in 2018.
All right. Have a great end of the year, guys.
Cheers.